You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, October 17th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Ari Berman from The Nation magazine on the GOP's white Southern Republican problem and their ongoing attempts to disenfranchise voters who are not white Southern Republicans. Also on the program, now that the snooze button has been hit on our long national nightmare, what comes next and what was in the deal? And what are the budget scolds and those who would promote the cutting of Social Security up to? I will tell you. Meanwhile, Republicans recovering from their Alamo, licking their wounds and finding actually that their wounds are a badge of honor. They won, ladies and gentlemen. And an important news story about the warrantless wiretapping. It seems the Solicitor General of the United States may have inadvertently lied to the Supreme Court about it. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? And a mother sends a letter to the New York State Board of Regents of Schools talking about her experience with her daughter and the data-driven testing and teaching regime that we are now adopting because of corporate school reformers. Folks, as you know, for this entire month, Credo Mobile is a paid sponsor of the Majority Report. Now, I've told you many times before, we've talked to Becky Bond from Credo. You know how Credo Action fights against Tea Partiers, but also fights equally hard to keep the Democrats from selling us out. They have a network of more than 3 million activists. They fight again for like Medicare, marriage equality. They're fighting hard against the Keystone XL pipeline. They've got what, like over 75,000 people who have signed a pledge to commit acts of civil disobedience to stop Keystone. Since 1985, they've given millions of dollars to progressive nonprofit groups like the ACLU, Democracy Now!, Planned Parenthood. Credo Mobile's revenues fund this, and Credo Mobile is sponsoring this program and giving a deal to Majority Report listeners. You get up to $350 for changing credit, I should say, on your bill to make up for any costs in switching over to Credo. Plus, you get 25% discount on data for 2 years, and they have a completely unlimited data plan. Go to credomobile.com/Sam to get that deal. Do it now, folks. Do not wait. Do it now. I'm not sure if this goes further than October. I think they're sponsoring us for a couple of months, but I'm not sure if this deal lasts past October 31st. I got to check on that. But either way, head over there, credomobile.com/Sam. Of course, we have links on the Majority Report blog. So, folks, let's talk about the Republicans. I don't know if I would call it a surrender, but it's a ceasefire, if you will. And why did they do this? Well, I think we may have found the answer. This is just from 2 days ago on the 700 Club.
The Republicans have got to wave the white flag and say, we fought a good fight, now it's over. They cannot shut the government down and then bring about a default. We can't do it. I mean, it would be devastating economically to every human being, and the Republicans just can't get tired with that. So they tried, and if they go to the electorate and say, we tried, Obamacare was awful, we tried to get it underway, and we weren't successful. The Democrats wanted it, they fought for it, and they wouldn't let go. So it's their bill, their program.
There you have it, folks. Pat Robertson is the voice of the Republican reasonableness. Now, of course, I'm sure he has huge investments that were in jeopardy. But remember, this is the guy who's being reasonable. This is what he said just days earlier.
You want him to grow the organ back? I mean, come on. No, seriously. I have had this story of Don O'Don, who actually had an eyeball recreated, and we've told that story. There are people who have had teeth grown, and we've told that story.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one great man of God was over in, was it Kenya? No, not Kenya. It was Ghana, I believe. 200,000 people. A man there that had his leg cut off, and while the service was going on, the leg grew back. We've talked about those things, but these are all creative miracles. What we're praying for is healing. These are creative miracles, and it's a different level of faith, a different level of working. But can God do it? Of course he can.
Right.
But don't sit on your couch and give us grief because we're not praying for legs to grow, for heaven's sake. If we could ask God to heal your cancer, I mean, thank him for that, please.
I don't understand. I don't understand why God couldn't just get rid of Obamacare.
Seriously.
He can regenerate an eye. He can cure cancer. Why can't he just get rid of Obamacare? Well, that's for the Republicans to figure out. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ari Berman. Are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to this program the inimitable are you a contributing editor or a contributing writer?
You had to search a little while for the word to praise me.
I know, of course, because I was afraid of underselling.
Really searching, I think.
Ari Berman, ladies really and gentlemen, Ari Berman. Welcome to the program, Ari.
Thanks for having me back, Sam. Pleasure is always mine.
So, Ari, as we sit here basking in the glow of a couple of tenths of a percentage point taken off our economy over the past couple of weeks, and the Republicans, I don't know that they certainly lost, but I don't know that anybody else won. Frankly, we are still at the sequester levels. Just quickly, give me your thoughts. Was it fun?
Well, I mean, it doesn't really seem like what are we celebrating here? I mean, this is going to happen all over again in 6 months. So really, basically, the hostage taking continues. It's just that they postpone the hostage taking for 6 months, and maybe they won't be able to do it down the road. But I mean, basically, there is another deadline here. So essentially what this seemed to me is a pointless exercise, but it's a pointless exercise that could still be repeated. And so I think it's good that there didn't seem to be any real major concessions made, but at the same time, we should have never had this fight to begin with, and we certainly shouldn't be having it again. And we're having the completely wrong conversation when it comes to the economy, because the whole discussion is still under the frame of what should we cut,
right,
as opposed to how should we create jobs. How can we stimulate what is still a weak economy? Why are we funding the government at sequester levels when every economist says we need to be pumping more money into the economy? I mean, all those things aren't even really part of the conversation. So in that sense, yes, it was a tactical victory for the president and the Democrats, but in terms of the frame of the conversation, it's still a victory for the Republicans.
There, you know, there are two things that occur to me, and I want to move on to the stories that you've written in The Nation about what's going on the voting front. But one, I'm not convinced this is going to be replayed. I think it was Ryan Grimm made a very good point last night. I can't remember what maybe it was on Hayes' show. That the filing deadlines for primary challenges for a lot of these Republicans will fall before the next debt ceiling fight. And I think I don't think they're going to go down this road again. But I also am not convinced that they're going to have to, because I think, we still are back to where we were a month and a half ago, which was the president really jonesing to cut entitlements for his legacy. And the other thing that we don't hear, which I think, you know, is typical, is that I think the cries of those of us on the left, and I know you were one of them as well, in 2011, that the sequester deal, that whole machination was a disaster at the time, I think had been thoroughly vindicated, because at the end of the day, you're right, we are still operating at sequester level funding, and the leverage still is with the Republicans. It's just that they don't know what to do with it, but eventually these morons are going to get their act together, and they're going to end up meeting the president in a place where the president wants to go and where the Republicans want to go, but the rest of us, I don't think, are going to be terribly happy with it.
Well, I think it's certainly true that the president, for some reason or another, has this soft spot for a grand bargain, and it doesn't seem to be something that he just did to posture for re-election. It seems to be something that he really believes in, that he wants to have this sort of Clintonian legacy of seeming like a responsible person. "Quote unquote responsible" when it comes to the deficit, and I guess he feels like if he can get this done, he can put it behind him and move on to other things. And so maybe the slightly more thoughtful Republicans, I hate to lump Paul Ryan into this group, but I mean he certainly seemed slightly more thoughtful during the whole last government shutdown debacle, particularly compared to some of his Tea Party compatriots. But I think they realize that the president has a soft spot. He offered Boehner an incredible deal from Boehner's standpoint in 2011, if you remember.
Yep.
And Boehner turned it down. So the question is, would Obama accept a deal like that? Would Republicans accept it now, knowing that that's probably going to be their best offer? Or basically, will the extremity of the Tea Party prevent them from taking what, in the normal course of things, would be a very good deal for Republicans? So, I mean, there's already a precedent here for Republicans getting a lot of what they want and for the president compromising. I just don't know what the political circumstances will be. I mean, it's funny that essentially Boehner held a vote that he could have held from the very beginning, getting a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans, and it's worth mentioning he could do that on a lot of bills right now that could pass. I mean, we could have immigration reform tomorrow if he would hold that vote. We could probably have gun legislation tomorrow if he held that vote. I mean, there's a lot of things that could get done if Boehner was willing to break the so-called Hastert rule. He's shown that he'll break it, but he'll only break it really when, like, the entire fate of the American economy is on the line.
Right. I mean, look, the bottom line is this is a fundraising bonanza for a lot of the Republicans, and it is just showering money on their entire operation. That's the one thing that I think is completely overlooked, is that this is all looked through the left and the center left, and the center seems to perceive this through the lens of ideology. And I think it's far more easy to explain if you just look at this as a cottage industry. And, essentially to the extent that there is a Republican Party, the aligned interests are really, more towards just being a very narrow sort of regional party, because it all does well for them. I mean, the radio metaphor would be you've got, three types of audience listeners: P1s, P2s, P3s. And P1s are your most rabid fans. And what's happened with the Republicans is they've lost the P3s. They're willing to give up the P2s as long as they can get their P1s to listen to every moment that they're on the air and everything that comes in.
Well, I mean, if you look at it first from the standpoint of members of Congress, I mean, so many of these Republican members of Congress are worried first and foremost about a primary challenge. They're not worried about the general election. I mean, it's like the 1950s South, when segregationist Democrats, all they had to do was win the primary, and they were guaranteed to win the general election. I mean, this is something that I wrote about recently. And so for them, I mean, for these Tea Party Republicans, I mean, the shutdown really doesn't hurt them because it just protects their right flank. Then for the National Party, you have, for example, the Ted Cruzes that are exploring, you know, a possible presidential run, and they're raising tons of money. They're getting a ton of Tea Party support. They're doing well among the rank and file in states like Iowa. And you see, for example, people like Rand Paul following them, Marco Rubio's following them. I mean, Marco Rubio's an interesting test case. I mean, at the beginning of the year, he was pushing immigration reform. He angered a lot of conservative Republicans by doing that. And so now what he's doing is he's letting as little distance between him and Ted Cruz as possible. And he's moving to the right. I mean, so even if Ted Cruz lost tactically, I mean, he's winning by pushing people like Marco Rubio, who are from the slightly more establishment wing of the party, over to the right as a result. And so, I mean, I don't necessarily think the Republicans learned a lesson here. I mean, I certainly think that the sort of northern moderates, to the extent that they still exist, I mean, they show their unhappiness with the party. And some of the more pragmatic conservatives show their unhappiness of the party. But in terms of the sort of Tea Party wing of the party, which is largely ascended in Congress and still has a lot of power among the Senate caucus, I don't really think that they've necessarily learned a lesson here.
No, and to the extent that they have, they said that we made a ton of cash. I mean, you know, everybody's talking about what they lost. What did they lose? They didn't, you know, I don't think they lost anything at this point. They just didn't get what they wanted. But that doesn't mean that they're at a deficit. And my P1 analogy here, I think, is it fits nicely with your piece that you wrote earlier this month about the GOP's white Southern Republican problem. I mean, this is their dilemma. They, you know, in radio, it was always a sense of, like, if you're only playing to your P1s, you cannot grow your base. But if your operational, if your expenditures are met by what your P1s are supporting you, then you're okay. And that's basically what the dynamic has been created with these Republicans, as you write about this white Southern Republican problem.
Well, I was really surprised because, I mean, I've known for a long time when it comes to issues like voting rights that the Republican Party is wider and more conservative than they've ever been. But when I actually crunched the numbers, I mean, what I found was that if you look at after the 1994 elections, there were 69 members of the South in the Republican Party in the House out of the majority. And today there's 98. So it's increased from 69 to 98. Remember, after 94 was the Gingrich Revolution, so there was a ton of white Republican Southerners in the House. It wasn't like they were a minority. I mean, they were really the governing class of the Republican Party. And for that number to have increased so drastically today, it just shows you that basically, you know, what Gingrich has happened, the sort of Gingrich Revolution is now on steroids when it comes to the House. And you have such a large percentage of the Republican caucus represented by very, very conservative Southerners who represent very, very conservative districts, because that's what's also changed in the South. It's not like white conservatives are representing swing districts where there's, for example, coalitions of moderate white Southerners progressive black Democrats they have to woo. They've drawn the districts in such a way that there's as many white voters as possible in as many districts and as few African-American and Hispanic voters in as few districts as possible. So the districts are so racially segregated now that there's no inclination for these white Republicans to compromise because they're in such safe congressional districts and they've bleached them to such an extent that they feel like they can continue this trend indefinitely. What it means for the Republican Party nationally, though, is that their party essentially is defined right now by white conservative Southerners.
And you quote Charlie Cook that between 2000 and 2010, the non-Hispanic white share of the population fell from 69% to 64%, but after the census redistricting that took place in 2010, and after the 2012 elections, the non-Hispanic white share of the average Republican House district jumped from 73% to 75%. So not only were they becoming more white at a time, just in general, they were becoming more white at a time where the entire trend of the country was going the opposite direction. And so that you're talking like a 5 to 8% swing there.
Yeah, I mean, this is the whole governing philosophy of the Republican Party is how do you stop demographic change? I mean, this has been their MO since Obama got elected. I mean, that's why they're resisting immigration reform. That's why they're making it harder for people to vote. That's why they're denying the expansion of Obamacare. I mean, all these things are about trying to stop a demographic wave that is really inevitable. And it's true that it's inevitable in the sense that demographic change is going to happen, but the question is, how will demographic change translate into the electorate? And Republicans are betting that they can do all these things to forestall this diversity of the electorate. Another thing that I didn't mention in this article is that Republicans are overwhelmingly also representing rural America, which is, of course, overwhelmingly white in most places. And so you have a situation where there's such a disproportionate power that, you know, essentially the white rural South has over the country. I mean, it's not like this is the demographic that should be ruling. I mean, essentially we have something of a statistical aberration that's governing at least one branch of the Congress right now. And some of it's based on how people live, and some of it's based on redistricting, and some of it's based on policy choices. But basically, the American political system is not representative of the demographics of the country right now.
Yeah, and just to remind people, the Democrats in the House received over a million more votes than the Republicans in the House, despite the fact that the Republicans, still maintain control. So it gives you a sense of just how sort of jerry-rigged the system is. All right. Now, I want to talk about, you had a piece yesterday, maybe it was 2 days ago, I guess, on what is happening now. Since the Supreme Court, and we have spoken to you about this in the past, and I would encourage people to go back and listen if you didn't hear Ari and I discuss the implications of the Supreme Court gutting Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which essentially was the formula in which the Justice Department would base their preclearance of voting changes in specific counties and states across the country. So let's talk about what's happening now as a result of that, because the Republicans in these states immediately took advantage of this, like literally the day after. What's happening in Arizona and Kansas?
Okay, so you mentioned that, right after the decision, basically eight southern states decided to either pass or implement new voting restrictions. Now they've gone further, and there's a new voter suppression tactic that's being used. It's not new in the sense that it's been used since the 1890s, but it's new in that it's being resurrected. And what's happening in Arizona, which is one of those states that was covered by Section 5, and also Kansas, a state that wasn't covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, is that they're essentially saying that if you don't show proof of citizenship to register vote, to register to vote under the National Voter Registration Act. So if you vote using this federal form that was instituted in 1993, which 28 million people used in 2008, if you don't show proof of citizenship, you can't vote in state and local elections. That they're going to set up two tiers of registration, one for federal elections and one for state and local elections. And this is the kind of thing that was done, for example, in Mississippi in the 1890s. It was also blocked under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act when Mississippi tried to do it again after the passage of the National Voter Registration Act in 1993, because basically what happened in 1993 is the National Voter Registration Act said that people can register, for example, at DMVs and other public locations, which drastically expanded access to voter registration. Arizona sued recently before the Supreme Court to say that they could require proof of citizenship even if it wasn't required under the National Voter Registration Act.
Now, wait, now let me stop you here for 1 second. Let me stop you here for 1 second to make something absolutely clear to people. There's a difference between affirming that you're a citizen and actually providing documentation. In other words, when people register to vote under the NVRA, they have to affirm under the penalty of perjury that they're U.S. citizens. So it's not like you can just go in there. You are putting yourself in legal jeopardy to register and sign off and check that box that you are a U.S. citizen. So this is not, it's not willy-nilly. It is simply that we're not going to take documentation because, first off, you know, why would someone who is an undocumented immigrant go in and subject themselves, they're already living in the shadows, why would they go in there and subject themselves just for the opportunity to vote? It doesn't make any sense.
No, I mean, of course, it's a crazy hypothetical, and there's no evidence that that's actually happening, that non-citizens are voting any sort of large numbers or that they're registering any sort of large numbers. But anyway, basically, Arizona said before the Supreme Court that proof of citizenship should have to be required no matter how you register to vote. The Supreme Court said no. They said that simply affirming that you're a citizen under penalty of perjury on the NVRA form was enough. It was a 7-2 decision drafted by Scalia, of all people. And basically, you know, Arizona has interpreted this decision as a green light for them to set up these two different registrations and to prevent people who don't show proof of citizenship from voting in state and local elections, which is crazy. I mean, you're disenfranchising possibly thousands of people and, you know, preventing them from voting in some of the most important offices, state legislative offices, mayor's races, all sorts of different local offices that matter a lot. So, I mean, this is something that I think is sure to be challenged legally. It's drawing a lot of scrutiny, and it's recalling a lot of bad memories. And I think one of the reasons people are so upset about it is because Arizona would have had to clear this voting change with the federal government. And there's a belief, based on the fact that the federal government blocked this already in Mississippi in the 1990s, that it would have been blocked in a place like Arizona. Kansas, they would have to sue under a different part of the law because Kansas didn't have to clear its voting changes with the federal government. But nonetheless, I mean, right now, it's just so much harder to block these kind of voting changes without Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah, so just so the people are clear here, I mean, this is basically saying you could go and register to vote in federal elections. You can vote for your congressperson, you can vote for your senator, you can vote for the president, and then you have to basically register a second time to vote in local elections. Just that aspect of it, you know, even if you didn't even require any further documentation, would be enough to disenfranchise people. And we've seen study after study after study. It varies, obviously, from state to state as to what the numbers are. But the states themselves have come up with numbers of just how many legitimate voters, registered voters, who simply do not have the documentation that is being required. Not everybody has a driver's license. Not everybody has access to their birth certificate. Not everybody can go a second time and take time off of work to go and register, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
We know, for example, we know after Arizona passed its proof of citizenship law in 2004, for example, which was subsequently blocked by the courts, that 30,000 people were prevented from registering to vote. I mean, that's a pretty substantial number of people. In Kansas right now, 17,000 voters have been prevented from registering because the DMV hasn't transferred their citizenship documents to local election officials. So, I mean, these are people that have met the proof of citizenship requirement, and they still can't register to vote. Not to mention that, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, up to 7% of people don't have proof of citizenship documents. Obviously, people aren't carrying a passport around a lot of times when they're registering to vote at a concert or something like that. I mean, and so this is something that is incredibly costly and confusing for election administrators. It's really confusing for voters. It makes it very hard for groups to conduct voter registration drives. It's just another example of how states are needlessly making it more difficult to cast a ballot and to even register to vote.
Now, if the Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division, if they are aggressive at this, okay, because, you know, I just want to give a broader explanation here. People should know that that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, just tell us what Section 3, Section 4, and what Section 5 had done, because I'm curious if, and I want you to lay that out for people, because I'm curious if the Department of Justice gets aggressive on this. It seems to me that finding that these states are doing this, when there's already an establishment that on a federal level, you have a sort of a lower bar, I guess, to vote. Could this be a means to opt in these counties and these states if the Department of Justice takes them to court and finds that these voting requirements are sort of racially motivated in some way?
Okay, so there's really four important provisions of the Voting Rights Act. One is Section 5, which I already mentioned, which says that states with the worst history of discrimination have to clear their voting changes with the federal government. The Supreme Court has said, okay, that's basically theoretically okay, but they struck down Section 4, which is the states that are covered under Section 5. So right now, Section 5 still exists. Theoretically, yes, you could clear a voting change, but no states are subject to it. So Congress has
Section 4 is the formula which says that Section 5 applies to you.
Exactly. So, I mean, right now, Congress needs to draw a new map for Section 4 so that those states have to get permission to enact a voting change under Section 5. The other sections which still exist, one is Section 3, which says that states that are guilty of intentional discrimination, a very high bar to clear, but nonetheless, states that are guilty of intentional discrimination have to clear their voting changes with the federal government for a period of time. So the Justice Department, for example, has sued North Carolina and Texas, both their voter ID laws and some other provisions as well in North Carolina, saying that they were enacted with intentional discrimination. That's going to be a very uphill fight. They've also sued them under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which is a nationwide ban on voting discrimination. Now, the problem with Section 2 is, yes, it applies nationwide, and yes, it is something of a substitute for Section 5. The problem is that now the Justice Department has to prove the burden of proof is on them to show that a voting change is discriminatory. It's not in the states anymore like it was under Section 5. And so these are very time-intensive lawsuits. They're very expensive. There's a very high burden for the Justice Department to clear to just win a Section 2 suit, not to mention that they would have to show intentional discrimination to win under Section 3. And so, for example, in North Carolina and Texas right now where the Justice Department is sued, under Section 5, North Carolina and Texas would have had to show the burden of proof. These trials would have happened quickly. It would have been a very swift process. Now this could take a year or longer to deal with in court. We don't know what the outcome will be. In the meantime, the voting changes are in effect. They're not suspended. And so for all that reason, there's just many fewer tools at the Justice Department's disposal than there were before. They're doing their best, but it's just much harder.
Okay. And so one of the other things that I think, you know, sort of gets lost in this conversation, Zachary Roth at MSNBC.com has a piece where he is looking specifically at Beaumont, Texas, and a school committee fight, essentially, that wherein Beaumont is trying to change the way members of the school committee are elected, essentially to get rid of the majority of African Americans who sit on the board. And this this is something where Section 5 has kicked in the past, but of course we no longer have Section 5 anymore. I mean, just tell us about this, because I think this also reveals just how sort of the scope of Section 5 and how important it is on a local level as well.
So 85% of the Justice Department objections in Section 5 cases have been at the local level. They've been able, for example, to protect Black, Hispanic, other minority representation on school boards and city councils and county commissioner's office and in state legislatures all throughout the South. And that's been super important because obviously these are people that run the day-to-day operations in towns and cities and counties. And so this is where the offices make the most difference. This is also where you hear the least about. So for example, under Section 5, it was very easy for the Justice Department to intervene in a mayor's race or in a school board race. But without Section 5, it's very hard to bring a challenge in these local races. It's very expensive. It's hard for the plaintiffs to get the funds. It's hard for lawyers to bring these kind of challenges. Nobody really knows about the voting changes. A lot of times they happen in these small towns, so people aren't aware of them. They don't get national news, for example. And so I think that's where you're going to see the biggest impact of Section 5. There are certainly going to be these statewide cases like in North Carolina and Texas that get a lot of attention. But there's going to be so many other changes where, for example, as you mentioned, I mean, basically what happened in Beaumont, Texas is a white minority on the school board has essentially tried to nullify the Black majority in that town. They were blocked from doing so under Section 5. Now they think they can do it without that federal protection there any longer. And the question is this going to be repeated all across the South? Are we going to see a situation where essentially 50 years of progress are wiped out in the span of a few years because, you know, all these local jurisdictions now decide to try to subvert the voting rights gains that have been made in the past 50 years? I mean, I think it's a very, very worrisome situation right now in terms of what's happening at the local level.
I mean, it seems inevitable, right? I mean, the same guys who brought us Shelby County. This is the case that the Supreme Court took up and used to invalidate the formula for Section 5. This I would imagine those same guys who have been looking for cases like this all the time are just going to go and do a PowerPoint in every town and every county across these states that are no longer subject to Section 5.
Well, I mean, I think they're certainly going to try. Some jurisdictions aren't going to want to deal with this. They're not going to want the legal fights or the national attention, or they're going to think that this is just morally wrong to do. But there's no doubt that more jurisdictions are going to try. We're already seeing them doing so. And so the question is, you know, what can you do about it? Can you shame them, you know, publicly? Can you file lawsuits? Can you win under other provisions of the Voting Rights Act? I mean, I think that's one reason why, you know, these challenges in North Carolina and Texas are so important, because if the Justice Department wins in these cases, it's going to restore some semblance of order. If they lose in these cases, I mean, really all bets are off, and it's really going to be incumbent on Congress to try to do something. I mean, it's terrifying thought to rely on Congress to do anything, given what we've seen in the last few weeks. But ultimately, this is Congress's responsibility. Congress passed the Voting Rights Act. Congress amended it 4 times. Congress can do it again. Maybe not this Congress, but this is at least something for Congress to aspire to in the future, because the status quo, as we're seeing already, is not one that's going to work very well in terms of protecting voting rights and protecting civil rights more broadly.
Lastly, is there legislation to deal with this new formula in Congress now? I mean, I understand that it's highly unlikely to be picked up in this session, and depending on the outcome of the 2014 election, there may be a better opportunity. But is there anything happening on this front in Congress?
Not yet. I think everything's been happening pretty quietly. I think the idea is that Representative James Sensenbrenner, Republican of Wisconsin, who was chair of the House Judiciary Committee in 2006 when the VRA was overwhelmingly reauthorized, I think voting rights supporters want him to take the lead because he is a conservative Republican, so he's the best face for this to try to recruit other Republicans to the cause. I think the hope is that he and then there's a working group of Black Democrats that are also looking at legislation, that maybe they could come together, have a proposal, and then at least groups can rally around it. People can at least say, hey, there is a bill in Congress. At the very least, it could become an election issue in certain places. You could start putting pressure on Congress and build towards some sort of long-term solution on this. But I don't think the legislation has happened yet, not only because it's politically sensitive, but also because it's difficult to do on a practical basis. I mean, Section 5 worked pretty well. I mean, it did get the states that were discriminating most often. It didn't get all of the states, but certainly the Texases, North Carolinas, Alabama, Georgias of the world, I mean, they were the ones that were the worst actors still. I mean, they were the worst actors in 1965, and they were the worst actors today. And they were covered, and so it's hard to figure out how you can, A, cover everybody, and then, B, do it in such a way that satisfies the Supreme Court. It's just a very, very difficult empirical task, not to mention an incredibly difficult political task, to get this Republican Party, which has shown itself to be so hostile to any sort of civil rights measures, to try to agree to anything.
And on the ground, in terms of organizing, is this, you know, we heard that the voter suppression was ended up in some respects being a leverage to drive people to the polls. Are you seeing a lot of gearing up in terms of community organizing to follow that sort of same formula?
I think in certain places. I don't think we should assume that it's going to happen everywhere. But for example, in North Carolina, right, one thing the Republicans tried to do after they passed this sweeping voter suppression bill is they tried to prevent students at historically Black colleges from actually running for office, saying that they weren't legally registered. They couldn't legally register where they were students. One of these students, Montravius King, at Elizabeth City State University in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, was actually prevented from running for city council. His case got a lot of attention. Rachel Maddow went down there. It became a national story. The State Board of Elections subsequently ruled that he could run for office, and he was the top vote getter in the recent city council elections there. And a third of the votes were cast by students, which is a very high number in the city council race. So I think in that case, absolutely. I mean, the Republican overreach elevated a race that probably no one would be paying attention to into a national battle. So to the extent that can happen, that's great, and I think it will backfire. But is that going to happen all throughout the South? No. And that's the problem is, you know, it takes a lot. It takes a lot of public attention, it takes a lot of legal attention, it takes a lot of political work to have this kind of voter suppression backlash. So I certainly would love to see it happen all across the country in 2014 and in 2016, but I don't think we should fool ourselves that right, somehow efforts to make it more difficult to vote are going to actually encourage more people to vote. I mean, that's not necessarily a thesis that I would rely on.
Right. I think we call that a bank shot. And a very difficult bank shot, indeed. Ari Berman from The Nation magazine, always a pleasure. Thanks for talking to us about this.
Thanks, Sam. I appreciate it.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program. You can call at 646-257-3920. Remember, Credo sponsoring the program. Go to credomobile.com/Sam. Get a $350 credit to buy yourself out of your existing contract, get 25% off of data over 2 years, get unlimited data, support progressive causes, support progressive nonprofits. It is a win, win, win. And, you know, in some respects, by supporting our sponsors, you're supporting this program. You can also support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. That is a straight line to support. Go to majority.fm, become a member today. Just pennies a day for great programming. And I am very excited, at the very least, that we're not in crisis mode. We can go back to sort of regularly scheduled programming where we continue to bring you some interesting stories and in-depth interviews where you will not hear anywhere else, anywhere in the world, maybe in the universe. You can also support this program by going to majority.fm, clicking on our Amazon link at the bottom of the page, bookmarking it, buying all your Amazon crap through that link, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. In 2 weeks, we will have you vote for us. Hopefully, if we're nominated for a podcast award, we will tell you more as that begins to happen. See you in the better half, 646-257-3920. IM is also on. Feel free to IM me. We'll be right back with more after this. Oh, we also got a great clip from Fox News. Fox and Friends, gotta do it. Maybe we'll do another random Rush, just because I know how pissed off he is today. And that always makes me smile. All right, we'll be back in a minute.